This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFK. If you're not already a member, consider joining with us and keep free speech alive.
Hello, I'm Liliana Sanchez, KPFK's local election supervisor. It is imperative that we meet quorum in order for our election to be certified. So please mail in the ballots you received from KPFK. They must be received no later than midnight on December the 11th. If you can't find or didn't receive your ballot, I will be at the station accepting and supplying replacement ballots on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, December 6th, 7th, and 8th from noon until 7 p.m. and on Tuesday, the 11th, the deadline date for ballots to be received from 3 p.m. until midnight. KPFK is located at 3729 Cahuenga Boulevard, West in North Hollywood. We're across the 101 freeway from Universal Studios. Thank you, and I hope to see you here.
Starting December 14th, KPFK will launch a new lineup of programming on Fridays. It will start at 1 in the afternoon with Page to Pantry with Nikki Gallucci, followed by Healthy Planet, Healthy Me with Sherry Beal at 2 p.m. And at 3 p.m., Michael Benner will launch a new version of his program with his wife, Doreen Key. That new Friday lineup again is 1 p.m., Page to Pantry, 2 p.m., Healthy Planet, Healthy Me, 3 p.m., The Michael Benner Show with Doreen Key, and the 4 and 5 o'clock hours stay the same with Bolcho Hour of Power and Beneath the Surface with Jerry Quickly. Alternative Radio with David Barsamian will move to the first and third Sundays of the month at 9 a.m., and the Tibet Connection broadcasts the fourth Sunday of the month at 9 a.m.
Siren screaming in my ear. Election days are colder when pushing from the rear is fear, fearing fear, fearing fear.
Hello, this is Blaise Bonpane with World Focus coming to you from KPFK Los Angeles, where we are podcast and available 24/7 on www.kpfk.org. Today I want to comment on some items of news. For example, we have the returning veterans, and a week or so ago we commented on the film In the Valley of Elah, and we had the producer Paul Haggis on the program. We're seeing the legacy of this war and many wars. Here's a report by Penny Coleman, a war widow, a Vietnam veteran who took his own life after coming home. His latest book, that's her latest book, is Flashback, the Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, Suicide, and the Lessons of War. Her blog is called Flashback. And here is what Penny has to say. Earlier this year, using the clout that only major broadcast networks seem capable of mustering, CBS News contacted the government of all 50 states requesting their official records of death by suicide going back 12 years. They heard back from 45 of the 50. From the mountains of gathered information, they sifted out the suicides of those Americans who had served in the armed forces. What they discovered is that in 2005 alone, and remember, this is just 45 states, there were 6,256 veteran suicides, 120 veteran suicides every week for a year, an average of 17 every day. As the widow of a Vietnam vet who killed himself after coming home, and as the author of a book for which I interviewed dozens of other women who had also lost husbands, sons, or fathers to PTSD and suicide in the aftermath of the war in Vietnam, I'm deeply grateful to CBS for undertaking this long overdue investigation. I'm also heartbroken that the numbers are so astonishingly high and tentatively optimistic that perhaps now that there are hard numbers to attest to the magnitude of the problem, it will finally be taken seriously. I say tentatively because this is an administration that melts hard numbers on their tongues like communion wafers. Since these new wars began, and in spite of the continuous flood of alarming reports, the Defense Department has managed to keep what has clearly become an epidemic of death beneath the radar of public awareness and systematically concealing statistics about soldiers' suicides. They have done everything from burying them on official casualty lists in a category they call accidental non-combat deaths, to outright lying to the parents of dead soldiers. And the Department of Veterans Affairs has rubber-stamped their disinformation, continuing to insist that their studies indicate that soldiers are killing themselves not because of their combat experience, but because they have personal problems. Active duty soldiers, however, are only part of the story. One of the well-known characteristics of post-traumatic stress injury is that the onset of symptoms is often delayed, sometimes for decades. Veterans of World War II, Korea, and Vietnam are still taking their own lives because new post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms have been triggered or old ones re-triggered by stories and images from these new wars. Their deaths, like the deaths of the more recent veterans, are written up in hometown newspapers. They are locally mourned, but officially ignored. The VA doesn't track or count them. It never has. Both the VA and the Pentagon deny that the problem exists and sanctimoniously point to a lack of evidence they have refused to gather. They have managed this smoke and mirrors trick for decades, in large part because suicide makes people so uncomfortable. It has been called that most secret death because no one wants to talk about it. Over time, in different parts of the world, attitudes have fluctuated between the belief that the act is a sin, a rite, a crime, a romantic gesture, an act of consummate bravery, or a symptom of mental illness. It never has, however, been emotionally neutral as an issue. In the United States, the rationalism of our legal system has acknowledged for 300 years that the act is almost always symptomatic of a mental illness. For those same 300 years, organized religions have stubbornly maintained that it is a sin. In fact, the very worst sin, the one that is never forgiven because it's too late to say you're sorry. The contradiction between religious doctrine and secular law has left suicide in some kind of nether space in which the fundamentals of our system of justice and belief are disrupted. A terrible crime has been committed, a murder, and yet there can be no restitution, no punishment. As a sin or mental illness, the origins of suicide live in the mind, elusive, invisible, associated with the mysterious and secretive and the undisciplined, a kind of omnipresent orange alert. Beware the abnormal. Beware the other. For years now, the administration has been blasting us with high decibel, righteous posturing about suicide bombers, those subhuman dastards who do the unthinkable using their own bodies as lethal weapons. Those people aren't like us. They don't value life the way we do, runs the familiar xenophobic subtext, and sometimes the text isn't even sub. Many terrorists who kill innocent men, women, and children on the streets of Baghdad are followers of the same murderous ideology that took the lives of our citizen in New York, in Washington, in Pennsylvania, and W. glibly conflating September 11th, the invasion of Iraq, Islam, fanatic fundamentalism, and human bombs, Bush has also expressed the opinion that suicide bombers are motivated by despair, neglect, and poverty. The demographic statistics on suicide bombers suggest that this isn't necessarily the case. Most of the September 11th terrorists came from comfortable upper to upper middle class families and were well educated. Ironically, despair, neglect, and poverty may be far more significant factors in the deaths of American soldiers and veterans who are taking their own lives. Consider the 25% of enlistees and the 50% of reservists who have come back from the war with serious mental issues. Despair seems an entirely appropriate response to the realization that nightmares and flashbacks may never go away. That is your ability to function in society and manage relationships, work schedules, or crowds. You will never be reliable. How not to despair? If your prognosis is, suck it up, soldier, this may never stop. Neglect? The VA's current backlog of 800,000 cases, aside from the appalling conditions in the many VA hospitals in 2004, the last year for which statistics are available, almost 6 million veterans and their families were without any health care at all. Most of them were working people, too poor to afford private coverage, but not poor enough to qualify for Medicaid or means-tested VA care. Soldiers and veterans need help now. The help isn't there, and conversations about what needs to be done are just beginning. Poverty? Symptoms of post-traumatic stress injuries or traumatic brain injuries are often make getting and keeping a job an insurmountable challenge. The New York Times reported last week that though veterans make up only 11% of the adult population, they make up 26% of the homeless. If that doesn't translate into despair, neglect, and poverty, well, I'm not sure the distinction is one worth quibbling about. There's a particular terrible irony in the relationship between suicide bombers and the suicides of American soldiers and veterans. With the possible exception of some few sadists and psychopaths, Americans don't enlist in the military because they want to kill civilians, and they don't sign up with the expectation of killing themselves. How incredibly sad that so many end up dying of remorse for having performed acts that so disturb their sense of moral selfhood that they sentence themselves to death. There's something so smugly superior in the way we talk about suicide bombers and the cultures that produce them. But here is an unsettling thought. In 2005, 6,256 American veterans took their own lives. That same year, there were about 130 documented deaths of suicide bombers in Iraq. Do the math. That's a ratio of 50 to 1. So who is it that most effectively is creating a culture of suicide and martyrdom? If George Bush is right, that it is despair, neglect, and poverty that drive people to such acts, then isn't it worth pointing out that we are doing a far better job? I say about, because the aftermath of a suicide bombing is often very difficult for observers to determine and how many individual bodies have been blown to pieces. These are the thoughts of Penny Coleman, a widow of a Vietnam veteran who took his life after coming home. Her latest book, Flashback, Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, Suicide, and the Lessons of War. Her blog is Flashback. Very important thoughts for us to have. Now, we had a very interesting referendum in Venezuela this last week, and we want to have some thoughts on that. With a registered voter turnout of about 55%, Venezuelan voters rejected two referendum questions, asking for approval of a total of 69 amendments to their constitution. Each question was defeated by a margin of 1.5 percentage points. As a result, Venezuelans will not have a constitution that gives them a 36-hour work week, that gives informal sector workers social security, that recognizes the contributions of African and indigenous people to the building of the Venezuelan identity, that eliminates discrimination in all forms. They also won't have a 7-year presidential term without term limits, definitions for the 4 classes of property, and other changes that on paper would move the country more rapidly toward what is being called 21st century socialism. Venezuelans get to vote on constitutional amendments, unlike citizens in the United States. In the U.S., 2/3 of both houses of Congress must approve an amendment, and then it must be approved by 3/4 of the state legislatures. Voters never get a direct say. Which country has the greater democracy? With 11 national votes in the past 9 years, since Hugo Chavez was first elected president in 1998, is it any wonder that Venezuelans follow only Uruguay among Latin Americans in their satisfaction with their democracy? It's time for the U.S. government and the U.S. corporate media to acknowledge that Venezuela is a vibrant democracy and Hugo Chavez is its elected president. He is not a dictator, and he obviously does not have autocratic control of the system or the amendments he supported. Otherwise, they would not have been voted down. It's time for the U.S. government and the U.S. corporate media to acknowledge that freedom of speech and assembly are alive and well in Venezuela. The wealthy opposition to the Bolivarian process owes a great deal to a great majority of print and electronic media that was completely free to attack the proposed amendments and Chavez himself. This is the power of the free Venezuelan commercial media. And it did this on a daily basis and in a language we would never see outside the blogs of the United States. So the power of media there is somewhat analogous to the power of media here. It is time for the United States government and U.S. corporate media to acknowledge that Venezuela's electoral process is free and fair. Its electronic voting machines issue paper receipts, which make fraud almost impossible. We can only wish that electronic voting in the U.S. were as reliable. A defeat by only 1.5% would have been converted to a victory by those in power in many countries. Mexico's long tradition of dirty elections easily comes to mind. It's time for the United States government to stop interfering in Venezuela's democracy, and time for the U.S. corporate media to stop aiding and abetting it. Reports that the U.S. government, through the U.S. Agency for International Development and National Endowment for Democracy, spent $8 million of U.S. taxpayers' money to influence the vote on the referendum. That would be the equivalent of a foreign country spending $92.6 million on a national referendum. If we had such a democratic tool in the U.S., would we tolerate that? The Venezuelan Solidarity Network organized a delegation to Venezuela back in October of 1996 to investigate U.S. government interference in that year's presidential election. The U.S. embassy official who met with us freely admitted that the U.S. was spending $26 million on Venezuela's presidential election. Now, what would be the reaction in the U.S. if Venezuela spent the equivalent $301 million on our upcoming presidential election? It's time for the U.S. government to close the Office of Transition Initiatives housed in the U.S. Embassy in Caracas. Venezuela's transition is a real democracy that began with the rejection of the old political parties of elites in 1998. It is alive and well, and it doesn't need any so-called democracy building from the United States. Indeed, there's a lot we could learn about democracy from the Venezuelans themselves. It's a very important thought, and we have some comments on that from a very well-known academic here in the United States, James Petras, who's written so extensively on Latin America for years. He refers to a Venezuelan government broadcast circulating a confidential memo from the U.S. Embassy to the CIA, which is devastatingly revealing of a U.S. clandestine operation which will influence the referendum that took place. They have the goods in this case. The memo sent by embassy official Michael Middleton Steer was addressed to the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Michael Hayden. The memo was entitled Advancing the Last Phase of Operation Pincer, and it updates the activity by a CIA unit with the acronym HUMINT, Human Intelligence, which is engaged in clandestine action to destabilize the referendum that took place and coordinate the civil military overthrow of the elected Chavez government. The embassy's CIA poll conceded that 57% of the voters approved of the constitutional amendments proposed by Chavez, but also they predicted that 60% abstention would take place. Now, we haven't interfered in any other elections, have we? The U.S. operatives emphasized their capacity to recruit former Chavez supporters among the Social Democrats and the former Minister of Defense, Baudouel, claiming to have reduced the yes vote by 6% from its original margin. Nevertheless, embassy operatives concede that they have reached their ceiling, recognizing they cannot defeat the amendments via the electoral route. In other words, apparently the CIA was actually surprised about their own actions. The memo then recommends that Operation Pincer, in Spanish that's Operación Tenaza, be operationalized. OP involves a two-pronged strategy of impeding the referendum, rejecting the outcome at the same time as calling for a no vote. The run-up to the referendum includes running phony polls, attacking electoral officials, and running propaganda through the private media accusing the government of fraud and calling for a no vote. Contradictions, the report emphasizes, are of no matter. The CIA embassy reports internal division and recriminations among the opponents of the amendments, including several defections from their umbrella group. The key and most dangerous threat to democracy raised by the embassy memo points to their success in mobilizing the private university students backed by top administrators to attack key governmental buildings, including the Presidential Palace, Supreme Court, and the National Electoral Council. The embassy is especially full of praise for the ex-Maoist Red Flag group for its violent street-fighting activity. Ironically, small Trotskyist sects and their trade unionists join the ex-Maoists in proposing the constitutional amendments. The embassy, while discarding their Marxist rhetoric, perceives their opposition as fitting in with their overall strategy. So here's the embassy reaching out to Trotskyists and ex-Maoists for help. The ultimate objective of Operation Pincer is to seize a territorial or institutional base with the massive support of the defeated electoral minority within 3 or 4 days, presumably after the elections, backed by an uprising of oppositionist military officers, principally in the National Guard. The embassy operatives concede that the military plotters have run into serious problems as key intelligence operatives were detected, stores of arms were decommissioned, and several plotters are under tight surveillance. Apart from the deep involvement of the U.S., the primary organization of the Venezuelan business elite, as well as all major private television, radio, and newspaper outlets, were engaged in a campaign of fear and intimidation. Food producers, wholesale and retail distributors have created artificial shortages of basic food items and have provoked a large-scale capital flight to sow chaos in hopes of reaping a no vote. Then, in a speech to pro-Chavez, pro-amendment nationalist business people, that is the entrepreneurs for Venezuela, Chavez warned that if he continues to threaten the government with a coup, that is, this group continues to threaten the government with a coup, he would nationalize all their business affiliates, and with the exception of the Trotskyist and other sects, the vast majority of organized workers, peasants, small farmers, poor neighborhood councils, informal, self-employed, and public school students have mobilized and demonstrated in favor of the constitutional amendments. The reason for the popular majority is found in a few key amendments. One article expedites land expropriation, facilitating redistribution to the landless and small producers. Chavez has already settled over 150,000 landless workers on 2 million acres of land. Another amendment provides for universal Social Security coverage for the entire informal sector, street sellers, domestic workers, self-employed, amounting to 40% of the labor force, organized and unorganized. The work week will be reduced from 40 to 36 hours a week, Monday to Friday noon, with no reduction in pay. Open admission and universal free higher education will open greater opportunities for education for lower-class students. Amendments will allow the government to bypass current bureaucratic blockage of the socialization of strategic industries, thus creating greater employment and lower utility costs. Most important, an amendment will increase the power and budget of neighborhood councils to legislate and invest in their communities. The electorate supporting the constitutional amendment is voting in favor of their socioeconomic and class interests. The issue of extended re-election of the president is not high on their priorities, and that is the issue that the right has focused on, calling Chavez a dictator and the referendum a coup. Well, these are a few thoughts. It certainly is reminiscent of what Guatemala did beginning in 1944 and continuing through 1954 when its government of spiritual socialism was overthrown by the United States and a military dictatorship was implanted by our government and has remained to the terror of the Guatemalan people ever since. But this is Venezuela, and this time, through tremendous media input and power, the referendum was lost. But the upside here is that the whole world knows that Chavez accepted this, and that is really very significant. So with strong financial backing from the U.S. embassy and business elite and free time by the right-wing media, the right has organized a majority of upper-middle-class students from the private universities, backed by the Catholic Church hierarchy, large swaths of the affluent middle-class neighborhoods, entire sectors of the commercial, real estate, and financial middle classes, and apparently sectors of the military, especially officials in the National Guard, while the right has control over the major private media, public television, and radio, back the constitutional reforms. While the right has its followers among some generals and the National Guard, Chavez has the backing of the paratroops and legions of middle rank officers and most other generals. So this was quite a historical event for Venezuela, but also for the rest of the Americas. A positive vote provides a legal framework for the democratization of the political system, the socialization of strategic economic sectors to empower the poor and provide a basis for self-managed factory systems. Unfortunately, the referendum was lost by Chavez, but we're extremely proud of the way that this was dealt with by him, and it certainly can come back again at a later date. So what would happen if there were popular opposition outside of the electoral system? A reversal could have led to a bloodbath, since we haven't seen since the days of the Indonesian general's coup of 1966, which killed over a million workers and peasants, or the Argentine coup of 1976, in which over 30,000 Argentines were murdered by the U.S.-backed general. So the referendum has taken place, and these thoughts are based on the writings of James Petras, a former professor of sociology at Binghamton University, New York, and who has written so extensively on Latin America. And he is reporting on what is called Operación Tenaza, Informe Confidencial de la CIA, a plan which developed by the CIA to make the Chavez desires fail in Venezuela. We will continue after a short break with the World Focus.
I'm Leslie Radford. Except for elections, you probably never hear from the LSB. It wasn't supposed to be like that. The LSB was supposed to link communities to the station, but it's turned into a cluster of insiders deciding who's it with each election. The LSB should speak from the people to the station and back again. So I'm asking you to elect newcomers from SoCal's progressive grassroots. Consider Rafina, Joaquin, Chuck. Look at Khalid, Reza, Lawrence, and China. Check out Mo and Jubilee. These people will bring KPFK out of the station and into the streets. They're on my website, radiojustice.net. Let's make KPFK power for the people. Again, I'm Leslie Radford.
Learn more about KPFK elections at pacificaelections.org. Your completed ballot must be received at the P.O. Box or the station by midnight, December 11th.
Hello, this is Blaise Bonpain coming to you with a continuation of World Focus from KPFK Los Angeles, where we're podcast and available 24/7 on www.kpfk.org. I'm privileged today to have Reese Ehrlich as a guest. Reese is the co-author of the best-selling book, Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You. In 2001, he produced a one-hour documentary, The Struggle for Iran, hosted by Walter Cronkite, and he's a segment producer for the public radio series Crossing East, which received a Peabody Award in 2007. His latest book, which could not be more timely, is The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy and the Middle East Crisis. Welcome, Reese.
Thank you very much, Bryce.
Well, we've seen a very interesting situation this week where we have the generals and the intelligence agencies trying to restrain our out-of-control administration and its 4 years of disinformation. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Oh, no. It's a reaffirmation of democracy.
I see.
And a continuation of everything that President Bush has stood for all along.
You know, I don't think he has any understanding of language. I mean, language is to mean something.
He also said that Denver won the World Series.
That's good.
And that Vice President Cheney walks around the White House in his underwear with a tin foil hat.
Well, that's very good. So Lieutenant General William Odom, Lieutenant General Robert Gard, Lieutenant General James Thompson, Brigadier General John Johns, and Colonel Richard Glass have to take out a full-page ad in the New York Times to tell him to lay off Iran.
Exactly. What happened was this is a huge blow to the Bush administration. They've been arguing that Iran poses some kind of immediate threat to the people of the United States and of the world, and that we have to do something, and probably bomb them. And now with the release of this national intelligence estimate, the consensus report of all the U.S. intelligence agencies, they say Iran does not have a nuclear weapons program, something that was obvious to the rest of the world, was obvious to the International Atomic Energy Agency. I wrote about it in my book, The Iran Agenda, long before this report came out. But it's good to see that the intelligence agencies have come around to that view. And I think it reflects the anger, as you said, of elements within the military, elements within the national intelligence establishment that is so ticked off at the Bush administration that even though they agree with the long-term goals, they all want to overthrow the Iranian government, they all want to continue the covert war that the U.S. is waging against Iran. These latest tactics by Bush just proved to be too much, and it blew up in his face.
I was very pleased in your new book to see the foreword by Robert Shearer, where he says that this perceptive analysis, Reese Ehrlich writes, in the spirit of Graham Greene, whose classic The Quiet American captured the naive but nonetheless murderous impact of U.S. intervention in the Third World of the Cold War era. Like Greene, Ehrlich blends an on-the-scene familiarity with everyday life in the target country with a piercing critique of the purportedly high motives of the foreign invader. Reese, we're in the midst of a Holocaust in Iraq, which has gone on now for going on 17 years. Every Iraqi considers it a 17-year war. And in the midst of this, one of the most horrible Holocausts in the history of the world, we're going to attack Iran?
Yeah, well, the U.S. has completely destroyed the country of Iraq, perhaps permanently fracturing it. I was in northern Iraq just 1 year ago. I visited in the KRG, or the Kurdish Regional Government area, and they are all but in name an independent state now, backed by the United States. We'll see what happens. There are factions among the Sunnis and Shias who want to split up the country along those lines, and that's a very real danger. And so we went from a situation where the Iraqi people could have eventually dealt with Saddam Hussein on their own and had a unified country to one in which the U.S. has devastated the country, the economy, the people, and quite possibly ending up splitting the country up.
Well, this is what Senator Biden seems to want to do. I think he's entirely out of it on this one, to break the country up into pieces, divide and conquer, I presume. Now, this Kurdish question, as relates to Iran, is quite an interesting thing. You have been aware of conflict there between the Kurds and the Iranians?
Here's what's going on. PKK is the Kurdistan Workers' Party. Is a group that's on the U.S. list of terrorist organizations. Now, I don't like that list. I don't like that designation because the U.S. obviously uses it for its own political means. But they are a group who have, who are waging, a nationalist group who's waging a guerrilla war in Turkey, denounced by the United States, denounced by the Turkish government. They kill soldiers and they kill civilians and they kill police, and they're branded as terrorists. There's a branch of the PKK that's made up of Iranian Kurds, and they do the same thing inside Iran. That is, they go across the border, blow up buildings, kill civilians, kill police and soldiers, and they are being funded and trained by the United States. And the hypocrisy there is just knows no bounds. The U.S. says the group is terrorists when they attack Turkey, and they're freedom fighters when they attack Iran. And, of course, this is all done in secret, and the U.S. doesn't admit it. But I reported on it for Mother Jones. Seymour Hersh has reported on it in The New Yorker. There have been a few other reports out about this. But the U.S. is waging a covert war trying to use the legitimate grievances that ethnic minorities have against in Iran. For example, the Kurds are most certainly discriminated against, as are the Baluchis and the Azerbaijanis and the other ethnic minorities. They have legitimate grievances. The government in Iran, even a future democratic government, have to deal with their legitimate concerns. But the U.S. is using and manipulating those concerns to fund basically attacks in which civilians are killed for political purposes, that is, terrorism.
Well, you know, just as every Iraqi is aware of a 17-year war which went on all through the Clinton administration with hundreds of thousands of deaths at that time, up to 5,000 children a month, so they're very much aware of that. Similarly, every Iranian is very much aware of a 1953 intervention which gave us a purportedly kingdom, renewal of the kingdom under the peacock throne of the Shah, and gave us one of the worst dictatorships in the history of the world, actually. But does anyone in this country know about that?
Well, you know, small numbers of people, but it's certainly not taught in the history books. And as with all things inconvenient for the U.S. empire. It's de-emphasized and not talked about a whole lot. Stephen Kinzura, New York Times reporter, wrote a very good book called All the Shah's Men, and the documents have now been declassified where the CIA brags about pulling the coup. And, of course, the irony is the U.S. today, and back then for that matter, talked about spreading democracy throughout the region and what great supporters of democracy we are. Well, Iran had a democracy, one of the few genuine flourishing democracies in a third world country of that era, in which there was not just voting, but genuine democratic elections, a functioning parliament, opposition political parties, a genuinely feisty free press, etc., etc. The U.S., that free and freely democratically elected government, voted to nationalize British oil, which was just beyond the pale for both the British and the U.S., and the U.S. organized a coup and took them about a year, in which they used every sneaky, underhanded, covert, illegal, immoral tactic you can think of, including murder, kidnapping, assassinations, false flag operations, etc. And again, don't take my word for it. Go look at the original CIA documents where they brag about it. They're online at the New York Times. And the installed the Shah. It was a brutal dictator who immediately, of course, eliminated the democracy, including the voting, and etc. But he was pro-U.S., so that was fine. And in a very real sense, the 1979 revolution, which came about when the people rebelled against the Shah, came about because of the U.S. installing the Shah in the first place, and the subsequent issues about a fundamentalist Shia regime in Iran that represses its own people is a direct outgrowth of the fact that the U.S. had replaced a democratic government in 1953.
Well, you made a very interesting trip with Sean Penn and Norman Solomon to evaluate what was going on over there. When you left, what were your feelings?
You mean when we left Iran?
Yeah.
Or when we left the United States to go to Iran?
Yeah, when you came back.
When we came back. It was very interesting. In 2005, the three of us, Sean Penn, Norman Solomon, and myself, went to Iran to cover the presidential elections, where ultimately Ahmadinejad was elected. And Sean went not as an actor, but as a correspondent for the San Francisco Chronicle. And what we met with lots of ordinary Iranians and a few top leaders. The people of Iran were overwhelmingly friendly to us. They were amazingly knowledgeable about the U.S., not only politics, but like things like film, and everybody knew Sean. It was really, in fact, at a certain point it got out of hand because we couldn't even go down for coffee in our hotel lobby without being mobbed by people and paparazzi. And I, for the first time in my life, got some appreciation of what it must be like to be a celebrity at that level. But Sean handled it very well, and so we had a chance to meet ordinary people, and the overwhelming message from everyone from Shirin Ebadi, the Nobel Prize peace winner, to student leaders, to everyone was, Bush's policies towards Iran are disastrous. It's making it more difficult for us to struggle for freedom and democracy in Iran. Leave us alone. Stop interfering. We'll take care of our own situation with time. We will change our government here. We're not interested in another U.S.-sponsored coup.
That is the message of people all over the world.
Indeed.
And we demonize them. We call them the axis of evil. And any time we go to these places without a gun in our hand, we find such friendly people that I recall in Iraq that were asking us to eat with them, to dance with them, to celebrate with them. People don't like you to come at them with an automatic
with a gun,
weapon.
With a rifle in hand.
Yeah, they
no,
really don't
what,
like that.
What, the same thing happened in Iran. You know, it's the tradition in that area to invite people over to dinner, complete strangers even. So here we're walking down the street in Tehran with Sean Penn, and people would come up and say, "Oh, Mr. Penn, you must come to my house for dinner."
Yeah.
You know, and we'd say, just once I thought, what if we said yes? Can you imagine the guy brings us home and says, "Excuse me, honey, yeah, can you throw a few kebabs on the fire? I got Sean Penn here for dinner. We'll sit down and brew the tea."
Yes. Now, you've had some very interesting reviews of your book, speaking of how it discusses the history of Iran's nuclear contacts with the U.S. way back in the 60s. And apparently we wanted Iran to have nuclear weapons. Is that correct?
Well, no, we wanted Iran to have nuclear power. In the 70s, when the Shah was in power, the U.S. almost demanded that Iran develop nuclear power. Why? Because the United States wanted to sell them the nuclear power plants. GE and Westinghouse weren't being very successful pushing nuclear power in the U.S. by that time, but they certainly expected to be able to sell them abroad. And so Iran had actually signed a total of 10 contracts with German, French, and U.S. companies to build nuclear power plants. Now, the U.S. was not officially encouraging them to build nuclear weapons, but the Shah periodically would make a statement to the media or something saying that Iran could have or he'd like to have or it wouldn't be such a bad thing if Iran had nuclear weapons. And there was never a murmur out of either Washington or Tel Aviv saying, oh, my God, Iran, we can't stand the idea of Iran having a nuclear weapon, because, of course, the Shah was an ally, and if he had chosen to develop nuclear weapons, the U.S. would have looked the other way, as they did with Israel, as they did with South Africa and Brazil.
Well, Rees, in your book, Chapter 3, you have Iran, Hezbollah, and Israel, The Real Story. What is the real story?
Dramatic title, wasn't it?
Yeah, I like it.
The real story is that Israel tries to demonize Iran, claiming that Ahmadinejad is the new Hitler, that he wants to wipe Israel off the map, that he's, there's going to be another Holocaust, and that we must do something. Even now, even in the face of the National Intelligence Estimate issued yesterday, the Israeli government is saying, no, our intelligence tells us that they're much closer to developing a nuclear bomb, and we should continue the same threats about bombing them and so on, although they're totally isolated now in the world on that one. In reality, what's really interesting, that slogan that's supposedly translated as we want to wipe Israel off the map,
yes,
is a very old slogan. It began in the 1980s under Ayatollah Khomeini, and an accurate translation of it is the entity in Jerusalem should vanish from the pages of time.
Yes.
Now, that's calling for regime change in Jerusalem. It's not calling for killing all the Jews or wiping out the Israeli state.
Yeah, well, we've had problems with translations for years. There's a saying in Spanish, the translator is a traitor. Traductor es traidor. It's very easy to be a traitor.
The irony of this is that slogan, that Israel must vanish from the regime must vanish from the pages of time, was in force. The Iranian position about Israel condemning Zionism, et cetera, calling for a one-state solution, was in place in the 1980s when the Israelis were supplying weapons to Iran. They were supplying arms and munitions and spare parts for Iran's fight against Iraq during the Iran-Iraq War.
Yes.
So the very same evil, anti-Zionist, Jew-hating, kill the Jews government that was in power in Iran. The Israelis were perfectly happy to supply them with arms in the 1980s, but because it's not convenient to Israel's policies today, they reverse that and say that, suddenly that slogan is mistranslated and means that they're going to attack Israel. And, all you have to do is think about one thing. If Iran was, in fact, an immediate threat of launching an offensive attack on Israel, why haven't they already done so with conventional weapons?
They won't. Of course. Now, when we talk about nuclear weapons and an attempt to build them in Iraq or Iran, we might ask, how did the arms race begin for nuclear weapons in the Middle East? Wouldn't it be slightly related to the fact that Israel has hundreds of these weapons and is ready to use them? Isn't that a slight threat?
Yeah, Israel has something like 200, 300, 400 nuclear weapons, so who's counting? Something along those lines. Interestingly enough, the U.S. initially objected to it, but went along with it when the French helped the Israelis develop their nuclear program in the late 1960s. So it's perfectly okay for U.S. allies to have nuclear weapons, but it's grounds for bombing if somebody doesn't have nuclear weapons, but they might think about getting them someday.
This irrationality simply cannot go on. It began some years ago with the statement, I think you have a nuclear weapon. Prove to me you don't. Now, that could be said to the island of Grenada or anywhere else in the world, but it was a wonderful thing. Prove to me you are not trying to kill me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm speaking today to Rees Ehrlich, who is the author of the best-selling book, Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, and he has recently published a new book, The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy and the Middle East Crisis, which is so significant today with the unveiling of another plethora of administration lies about Iran in their effort to kill the children of Iran, as they have massacred the children of Iraq for 17 years. This has to stop.
And the book is available in finer bookstores throughout the Los Angeles area. And for more information, go online to theiranagenda.com.
Take a look at that web I did. It's www.theiranagenda.com. And it will tell you quite a bit about the book. And it is very, very helpful in understanding this relationship, which is one of just runaway militarism. Now, you mentioned what the media didn't tell you in Chapter 9. Haven't they told us everything?
Well, yes, of course. Don't you believe everything you read in the L.A. Times?
Oh, yeah.
I certainly do. And you add a few AM talk radio stations and Fox News, and you're pretty much covered.
Oh, yeah. You won't know anything.
You'll be totally confused.
The more you watch, the less you know.
Yeah. Well, see, this is why this national intelligence estimate is going to be so important, because not only does it pull the rug out from all the lies the Bush administration has been telling, but the media ought to go back and do a little mea culpa as well, because I've met and talked to reporters from the LA, New York Times, and all the major media who have told me, of course Iran is developing nuclear weapons. We all know that. The only question is, do you use sanctions to force them to stop, or do you bomb them? That's the consensus opinion among the U.S. media, and you can see it throughout the articles of the major media. In my book, in that chapter, go into chapter and verse, you know, exact citations of articles in all of the major media, citing how they've kind of a blow-by-blow account, how they distort, how they go along. Basically, what it comes down to is it doesn't matter what's happening on the ground in Iran or in Iraq. What matters is the consensus of opinion makers in New York or in Washington that they listen to. So a good example is that I mentioned the covert war that the U.S. is waging against Iran. This is no secret. It's been going on for 2-3 years. A few heroic reporters like Cy Hirsch from The New Yorker have been writing about it. But it has yet to make it into the New York Times, for example, or to my knowledge, into the L.A. Times. And why? It will only make it into those publications when somebody in Washington, such as a CIA official or Department of Defense official, admits that it happened. Then it's real.
We had Cy Hirsch here a couple of weeks ago. We're so pleased to have his presence. And he said there are two options for leaving Iraq. One is to leave today. That's Plan A. Plan B is to leave tomorrow. And I think those are the only intelligent options. People say, what if there's a civil war? No, what did they ever care about anything in that country before? What did they care about the children who are being massacred since 1991?
Let me deal with I think there are listeners undoubtedly out there who do worry about, given the fact that the U.S. has made such a complete wreaked havoc on the country, what is the responsibility of the United States to the people of Iraq? And right now, the country is going through a civil war, is sponsored basically by the United States. And the U.S. does have a responsibility to help rebuild the country. But you got to pull the troops out, stop the occupation, let the Iraqi people resolve the issues among themselves, and then the U.S. can talk about which should basically pay reparations, although I don't think they'll ever call it that, to the people of Iraq to help them rebuild their country. But the number of American troops dying and the number of civilians dying will simply increase, and it's not going to be ended. It's not like the U.S. presence is somehow going to stop the civil war from happening.
Well, you mentioned in Chapter 10 learning the lessons of Iraq. I'm so afraid we have never learned a lesson. We didn't learn anything in Indochina. We have learned nothing from
Central. Certainly the top-level government officials did not. I think ordinary people in this country, at least some, did.
Yes.
And that's one of the reasons why the Iraq War, despite all the genuine problems, the popular opposition to the war in Iraq developed much faster than it did in Vietnam. It took many years of the U.S. presence in Vietnam before public opinion shifted against the war.
Yes,
and
that's true.
It happened fairly rapidly here, and it's been consistent. The Bush administration is totally isolated from the American people on the issue of the Iraq War and even on the question of bombing Iran. And that was one of the reasons why they had to shift tactics on Iran.
Just think of it. It takes our intelligence agencies and our generals to attempt to stop the administration. This is unheard of. Here are the very, you might say, hawkish elements in our country that are telling the president, you're wrong. This is really, I don't know that this has happened before, do you?
The thing to keep in mind is that these folks are strong supporters of the empire. And what they see is what a tactical blunder it would be for the U.S. to bomb Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And to their credit, they blew the whistle on the administration. But as I said, they all support economic sanctions, U.N. sanctions, the covert war. They're all united around that.
I think that's
so
a good
I would
point.
Be a lot more pleased if some of those intelligence and Defense Department officials would come out and blow the whistle on the covert war and really blow this thing wide open.
Well, that is something that is always undercover, even now as we see it in Venezuela as well, with the whole plan, the pincer plan, to attempt to overthrow the government of Chavez. So we do see that internationally, and apparently there's been no brakes put on that, that's for sure. In the foreword, Scherer says that Ehrlich avoids the path of crude demonization that has characterized most popular writings on the subject. Instead, he skillfully melds personal observations with a scholar's insight into the historical record that informs today's passions, passions that we ignore at our peril. So I think that's a good reason for our listeners to read your book, and I would suggest they go to the website www.theiranagenda.com in order to get a little background on this book and the real story of U.S. policy. So you have spent some time reporting from there as well. You were on the Afghan Iran border. What did you find as you stood in that minefield?
Well, you know, sometimes we reporters like to describe things as being like a minefield. Well, I was actually in one.
Yeah.
I walked real carefully.
Yeah, I can imagine. You looked like you had a little bit of armor on there.
Yeah, I had some of all those Kevlar vests and helmets and all that good stuff.
Right.
Luckily, it was a UN minefield, and so they had it clearly marked. And
wow.
You can. I wasn't actually in danger of like blowing myself up. That was in Afghanistan, actually, and I was doing a story about UN mine clearing efforts. That country is just strewn with landmines laid by the Russians, by the various Afghan groups, by the U.S. So, what I think people don't think about sometimes is that even after the hostilities end in a country, the cleaning up of the environment, the cleaning up of the landscape of the munitions is a horrendous problem. I really got a sense of that when I was doing that story about the landmines.
Minefields all over the world, Korea, endless fields of minings, and the children suffer.
Mm-hmm.
And the mines
are cluster bombs that intentionally don't explode or that they know will not explode. Then are picked up by children and killed.
These are horrendous things. Some of the mines are designed definitely simply to blow off arms and legs so that they will inhibit the military on the other side.
That's right.
Absolutely unacceptable. Any final thought for us today, Reese? We're running out of time.
Sure. Just a quick one is that I consider myself a sober optimist. And by that I mean I look soberly at the power of those in Washington and around the world. But I'm optimistic because despite all the bellicose threats and anger that comes out of the Bush administration, they really are weak. The Republicans are scrambling. They're worried about losing the elections next year big time. I think this release of this report is a huge setback for their plans to attack Iran. They are not all powerful. They are subject to the pressure from the people of this country, so keep it up.
I fully agree with you, and optimism is the word. I want to thank my engineer and editor, Stan Mizrahi, and I certainly want to thank you, Reese Ehrlich. World Focus is produced by the Office of the Americas. You may hear this program any time of day or night, 7 days a week, by going to www.kpfk.org. Simply click on Archives and then click on World Focus. Thanks so much for listening. This is Blaise Bonpain.
The Federation of Scientists Wizard Show on KPFK from 1980 to 1995. Our program was taken off the air and banned during the illegal takeover attempt. Significant educational material not found on normal radio stations is supposed to be aired on KPFK. That's the basic Pacifica philosophy. My efforts on the LSB, if elected, would be to promote a better correlation between present program content and the educational mission so unique to KPFK. I'm also one of the 9 candidates from the committee to strengthen KPFK, and I suggest you consider voting for all 9 of us. Again, I'm Shel Plotkin, and I thank you for listening.
Learn more about KPFK elections at pacificaelections.org. Your completed ballot must be received at the P.O. Box or the station by midnight, December 11th.
It's just a restless feeling by my side.
You've been listening to World Focus on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. Visit our website at kpfk.org, where you can hear us live worldwide and listen to past shows. Back